Really, it's about an 18-inch lift from the front seat. I actually prefer visibility-wise from the rear seat. You can see a little bit better, with the exception of directly in front because of just the way the windscreen configuration is of our two-seaters. We've got reconfigured the windscreen on our new S model, so it's a one-piece windscreen, whereas before it had sort of three pieces. The rear cockpit still has the three pieces, so there's a center section that has a little bit of a limited visibility, but for the most part, because of the rake of the windscreen and everything else and the canopy itself, the visibility is actually much better. And since you could see the bubble portion of the canopy in front of you, it looks sort of like the nose of the aircraft, and it seems like you're in the front seat, except that you have a little bit better visibility. But for the most part, a little bit tighter in the rear cockpit as far as the space goes, but overall it's not real bad up there. Just sit up a little bit higher.
The early versions of the U2 were completely unpressurized, and that accounted for the spacesuit that everyone had to wear. You do have partial pressurization now, I know, but talk about the attire. You don't just jump into your green bag and climb in, do you?
Oh, no. We have David Clark makes a really nice full pressure suit, we call it. It's a S1034 pressure suit. It's a bit like a dry diving suit, in that you're fully encapsulated in this suit. Now, the early suits that David Clark made were what we call a pinch suit, and they had these capstans along the edges which actually inflated, and it pinched the garment to you, and it, oftentimes the guys would take it off and they would have bruising all over their body from all the pinching that went on. The full pressure suit actually gives you air in the suit, and the controller will trap the air in there so that if you lose your cabin pressure, because the suit is only a backup system for the cabin pressure of the cockpit, if you lose that cabin pressure, it sustains you at 35,000 feet inside of the suit itself.
The only difference is that you look a little like the Michelin man.
That's pretty much true. Each one of these suits is roughly $250,000 each. Each pilot is custom fitted to them. We get two each, and the helmets are roughly about $75,000 each. We only get one of those, though.
Wow, that is expensive, no doubt. How long is the preparation time to get a pilot ready to fly the U-2?
Well, normal day, if you will, is we show about 2 hours and 15 minutes prior. We'll have a high-protein, low-residue diet, typically things like steak and eggs or chicken or whatever your stomach can take early in the morning. And from then on, we'll go get our weather briefing, take care of our flight planning. We'll brief ourselves on the mission of the day, whether or not we need a backup pilot or any other alternate missions or anything of that nature. And then we'll go and suit up about an hour and 20 minutes prior. We'll be on 100% oxygen an hour prior. And we typically will go out to the aircraft about 45 minutes prior while we're still pre-breathing 100% oxygen. We pre-breathe 100% oxygen to denitrogenate our bodies, so that we lessen the chance of decompression sickness, or what most people would refer to as the bends, while we are flying. And then, of course, we take off on time, and normal sortie durations are operational mission-wise last anywhere from about 9 to 10 and a half hours.
It's interesting that you compare it to the bends, because it's backwards to the way people would normally think, but you're under pressure as you climb to altitude, and then a sudden decompression at 70,000 feet. If my guess is correct, you're operating at about 0.5 pound per square inch. Is that about what you've got up there?
The suit will actually keep you at about a 3 psi differential, but for the most part, even though we have a rapid decompression, our cabin pressure is actually close to 30,000 feet, and the suit will maintain us basically at 35,000 feet should we lose a cabin pressure. So really, the rapid decompression is only roughly about a 5,000-foot difference.
So the procedure would be, as the mask drops from the overhead compartment, put yours on first, then
that's
your
right.
Later.
The one problem that we have with this rapid decompression is that most of the suits, as you know, like you blow into a rubber glove, will grow. And so it's not uncommon for your head to start sinking into the suit as your helmet starts growing above you. So we have a little take-up assembly that you pull down, we call a helmet tie-down, so that we can actually, with a pulley system, pull our helmets back down to our heads so we can see out again.
The U-2 provides reconnaissance on a global range and has got global reach. You have a vast operating range, But typically, the missions are one way. You go start from one base and then fly to another base, and then the situation is reversed. How many U-2 bases do we have around the world currently, Huggy?
Oh, we're currently operating out of three operational locations, Korea, the Eastern Mediterranean, and the Middle East. And then we've got our primary, the mothership, if you will, at Beale Air Force Base, where the 9th Reconnaissance Wing is at. There's also a small U-2 presence in Palmdale, California, Southern California, in the Mojave Desert. And that's where we do all the major modifications to the aircraft. It's where the new sensors get tested. It's called our U-2 Flight Test Center. But a small presence from the operational side, but a great deal of engineers are out there and so forth.
Now, today's U-2 is about a third larger than the original ones. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes, sir.
And what other differences have been built into the aircraft over the years? It's, 1957 the aircraft was originally designed?
1955,
55,
yeah,
okay.
That's correct. But in the early 80s, we went to the S model. Like you were saying, it's about 40% larger. It's got a different engine in it. Vast array of differences avionics-wise. About 2002... we went to an all-glass cockpit, so we have multifunction displays, we've got fiber optic cabling from all the different equipment bays and locations that we have. So while the aircraft named a U-2 has been flying for 53 years, this one is a fully modernized airplane doing the mission today.
It's not the same U-2 your dad drove around.
Or your grandfather.
That's right.
Joan Cabigas, I know that as part of the training regimen that you have for the U-2, the T-38, figures into it quite extensively. Could you talk to me about the relationship between training in the T-38 and then eventually stepping into the U-2?
Well, really, as far as the use of the T-38, we don't really get to fly the U-2 very often. It's not uncommon, even for an inexperienced guy, to only fly the U-2 maybe three or four times a month. And in so doing, you don't really get a whole lot of currency as far as just flying, proficiency, I should say. So we use it as a companion training aircraft, and we maintain our proficiency in flying with it. So most of the inexperienced pilots will get at least five sorties in a T-38 minimum per month, and it's not uncommon, depending on of our pilot load, to be able to get more than that. And of course, the higher up you go as far as hours and experience in the program, you tend to fly it less than the inexperienced guys, because the inexperienced ones need the flying time in it. And that's why we use the T-38. And then we do actually fly both simultaneously, so we maintain our proficiency and our currency in both.
The U-2, operationally, you take off from Beale or one of the other bases. As you set off on your mission, where is the optimum altitude for the aircraft in terms of reach and in terms of distance?
We really don't have an optimum. We just climb the entire time. When we brake release for the takeoff, we put the throttle all the way forward, and we leave it all the way forward, and we climb for the duration of the sortie. As we burn off fuel, we get lighter, obviously, and we continue the climb.
So you're actually climbing continuously all the way through the mission until you reach a service ceiling or a place where you want to be?
Yes, sir. We don't have a service ceiling. We just keep climbing. So we set a Mach, and as our weight burns off, you know, our fuel burns off, we just continue to climb.
Hmm. Well, it's an interesting flight profile. I know that one of the things that's been mentioned is how tight and how close the actual numbers are as you start to get to altitude. I know your stall speed is somewhere close to your cruise speed, and that's somewhere close to your VNE.
It really is. As you do climb up, your indicated airspeed begins to drop down, approaches stall speed. But the whole time in our climb profile, we're only about 6 knots away from our VNE. So again, as you climb, you get into what they call the coffin corner. It's actually not too bad. It sounds a lot worse than it is. In the old C model, which you talked to earlier, the smaller version of the U-2, which was built in 55 through 56, they built 55 of them then. That one was actually a very, very, very small window between stall and between the Mach buffet as you get up in altitude. In fact, they had a certain part of their climb profile they called the throat, and when they went through the throat, they only had about a 2-knot range. So, you know, I always joke with people about, well, if you can't you know, hold plus or minus 2 knots on a check ride, then, you know, how could you survive flying the C model?
Absolutely. That speed envelope happens at both ends, of course, as you come down. But what are you actually indicating at 70,000 feet?
Oh, at 70,000 feet?
It's about 101 indicate, 101 knots.
101 knots, and what's your true airspeed at that altitude?
410 knots. In fact, there goes the T-38 right behind us there, taking off... Training Command T-38, it looks like. But no, it's about we when we're at 0.7 Mach, we're doing about 410 knots true airspeed, and there's usually no more than about 10 knots of wind up there, so we can plan on a 410 knot ground speed.
Wow. We're listening, ladies and gentlemen, to the U-2 crew and the T-38 crew from Beale Air Force Base in California, who brought their beautiful U-2 here for us and for our viewing pleasure. And you're listening to EAA Radio, AM 1210, 100.7 FM, and on the web at airventure.org/radio.
Radio.